So my name's Sahar Jatara, and yeah, I've just come off solitary, and I don't know what made me think that would be a good space to be to come and give a talk, because I actually slightly feel like a sort of mad woman that's just sort of sitting up front and someone's going to come and sort of drag me off in a minute. But I have written a talk. It's based a bit on a talk I gave last year. It's a theme that I've been thinking about quite a lot over the last few years. I've done quite a lot of kind of hands-on activist kind of stuff over the years, and quite a lot of stuff, kind of green stuff within Tree Ratna. But I kind of want to give something that isn't just another talk on sort of facts about climate change and habitat loss. You know, it's a bit of a different angle on it. So anyway, I hope it makes some sort of sense. I was sort of writing it every day on the retreat, and then I read it back this morning, and it just seemed like, God, that's a lot of words. You know, but you haven't been speaking, you know. So yeah. Okay. Okay. So the talk's called "The Green Buddha and the Green Man." So I'd like to begin with a quote from one of Bhante's lectures, "Religion, Ethnic, and Universal." So Bhante Sangharachita was once asked, "What must happen before Buddhism can really flourish in this country?" And he replied, "There must be a revival of paganism first." So paganism is something that's quite close to my heart. And my spiritual journey, my own spiritual journey, began when I was really quite young, so sort of preschool age. I had this particular experience where I was playing in the garden with my sister. We were playing on the coal bunker, as you did in those days. Bits of coal. It's really old school. So we were playing this game, and I just suddenly had a sort of really weird feeling come over me. And it sounds really corny, but it was as if a voice had called me. So I stood up and looked around, and the sky was just the most amazing sunset. The sky was just completely on fire with this most beautiful sunset. And what happened was that I completely lost any sense of a subject-object duality. There was no longer any separation between things. In fact, you couldn't really speak of there being things anymore. But if we were to talk in terms of things, it was as if love resided equally in all things. And there was this incredible sense of peace and perfection. So generally, speaking for myself at least, we tend to experience the world as there being sort of an us in here and an everything else kind of out there. But in reality, this isn't the way things are. In reality, there is no such separation. So this experience began to happen quite regularly from that time on through childhood. And at that time, it used to only arise in the beginning when I was in nature. And because I was about 4 at the time, so with my sort of child's mind, I just sort of assumed that it was the presence of God and that God was somehow manifest in nature. So I used to call this experience the oneness. And a few years later, I came across some lines by William Wordsworth. Again, I was in the garden, and I had this old poetry book. I was about 9. And the lines were, "The earth and every common sight to me did seem apparelled in celestial light." So I read these words, and they just seemed to evoke this experience of the oneness. That which was seemingly ordinary was in fact suffused with celestial light. Or to put it another way, everything was holy. It'd be really embarrassing to start crying. So through this I became interested in religion. And in the library of the town where I lived, where I grew up, there was this one huge bookcase that was full of books of sort of an esoteric nature. So there was sort of like astral projection, which I never got anywhere with, just to say, and palmistry, tarot, Eastern religious thought, and witchcraft, and stuff like that. And I'd like to be able to say that, that I was intuitively drawn to Buddhism, but I wasn't. I was intuitively drawn to witchcraft and the old religion. So I kind of, through my childhood, made up this kind of synthesis of paganism and Christianity, whereby God was the love that was sort of mysteriously manifest in all things, and particularly in nature. And all things, not being separate from God, were therefore holy. So I've got some lines from Allen Ginsberg which really express this. Holy, 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 holy. The world is holy, the soul is holy, the skin is holy, the nose is holy, the tongue and cock and asshole holy, everything is holy. Everybody's holy, everywhere is holy, every day is in eternity, every man's an angel. So the earth and the celestial light are not separate. And I pursued this path well into my 20s, and I really enjoyed it. So there was sort of lots of naked dancing on burial mounds, a bit like my solitary actually. Lots of chalice water was drunk, and sort of various crystals were charged up around various standing stones, you know, and the Cern Abbas giant was venerated in the traditional way. But at a certain point, it kind of occurred to me that I wasn't making much spiritual progress. This sort of oneness experience came and went. But the rest of the time, I wasn't always in very good shape, you know. I had really low self-esteem, my sexual relationships were quite dysfunctional, I drank too much, and so on. So I started looking around for something that I thought might help. As I say, I wasn't actually interested in Buddhism, but I happened to meet Jayaraja when I was 23, and that experience changed my life. So how I met him was, I wanted to do something that was out on the land, something that was close to nature, and I'd previously done this employment training scheme, as they used to be in those days, and the scheme that I'd done first was archaeology and education. So basically, we had this like reconstruction Iron Age house out on this site in nature, and we basically just sort of ran around for a year sort of getting stoned and drinking mead and pretending to be Celts. And I really loved it, so I was thinking like something like that would be great. But the only thing that I could find was this other thing which was called Adventure Unlimited, and this was like rock climbing and abseiling. So I don't know if you've ever rock climbed or abseiled when you smoke a lot of weed. Recommended. But it did get me out into the woods. And Jayaraja, who was just coming up for ordination at the time, he was the instructor on the course. So through him, I learnt to meditate and I found the Dharma. And quite quickly, I came across things which were really important to me and are still really important to me. Water. So one of the things, which is probably the main thing actually, was Vasantra's book Meeting the Buddhas. I kind of just read it in one go through the night. And through that book I came across Green Tara, who is my Yidam, the figure that I meditate on. We've got this really beautiful Green Tara shrine here today. And I also came across this idea of the Bodhisattva vow. So Bodhi meaning enlightenment and Sattva meaning being. The Bodhisattva is an enlightenment being, and the Bodhisattva makes a vow to gain enlightenment for the sake of all beings, for the sake of all that lives. So when I read about the Bodhisattva vow, I knew that I had found what was best and noblest and of most worth in the universe. And just to add that it meant a lot to me that this vow was extended to all beings and not just humans. So another thing I came across in those early days was Bhante's taped lectures. And they really were tapes in those days. There were no CDs or free Buddhist audio. And the first lecture I listened to was the Heart Sutra. And it totally blew me away. And I spontaneously entered that state that I called the oneness. And it made me realise that this is where the Buddhist path could take us. You know, this is where the Buddhist path was leading, and that was enlightenment. So the other lecture that really moved me at the time was the previously mentioned religion, ethnic and universal. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that. In this lecture, Bhante explains that there are two kinds of religion. Ethnic religion, which is the religion of a particular locality at a particular time, and it's identified with the culture of that area. And it's collective by nature, so you can't point to particular founders. And then there's universal religion, such as Buddhism and Christianity, which can be the religion of any individual at any time, in any place, and which one converts to as the act of an individual. And the important point here is that universal religions only arise in the context of ethnic religions. So Buddhism arose in the midst of Hinduism, Christianity arose in the context of Judaism and Islam. And the thing is, there's a continuity between the two. The ethnic has its branches in the universal, and the universal has its roots in the ethnic. But what happened here 1,500 years ago is that our religious life, which was paganism, was completely disrupted by the coming of Christianity. So sacred groves were cut down, druid priests and wise woman healers were killed. When Padmasambhava brought Buddhism to Tibet, he incorporated the local demons and deities, and they agreed to protect and serve the Dharma. He didn't sort of superimpose Buddhism onto the Bon religion. He seamlessly merged the roots and branches of the two. But what happened here with the arrival of Christianity was that our ethnic religion was pretty much lost. It's true that you do often find green man images in churches, and that churches were often built on sites where there are sacred yews. But the old religion, as we once knew it, was destroyed. And what we've lost is the understanding that we are part of nature. Christianity teaches that man has dominion over all other life forms and is somehow special because man is made in God's image. And where there were once many gods and goddesses, there was now only one God, male, and living somewhere in the sky. To some extent, ancient religions always contained elements of trying to control natural forces, to appease the more destructive elements of nature. To make the hunt successful, to increase fertility, and so on. You know, I'm sure we've all seen The Wicker Man. You know, one should always be open to the generative influences. But ancient religions also contain strong elements of worship and even reverence. And most vitally, we did not experience ourselves as somehow abstracted from and superior to the rest of nature. So I was fortunate in that not long after I learnt to meditate, Buddhafield, or what would become Buddhafield, began to lead retreats out on the land. And Buddhafield was particularly elemental in those early days. We didn't have a cooker. We used to boil all our water and cook all our food on an open fire. And keeping this fire going was a sort of major preoccupation, you know. When it rained, the water table, you know, the fire pit would flood, and I can remember sort of on more than one occasion sort of bailing out this fire pit with a baked bean can in the dark, you know, trying to save the fire. You know. And we didn't have compost toilets, we just had like trenches in the ground that you had to squat over. And I had like dreadlocks down to my knees at the time, so it was actually quite a mindfulness exercise as well. And in one of those fields that we used to use for those early retreats, there was a shrine to the goddess, to the earth goddess. So, there was a place in this field where a little spring came up, and it was surrounded by small bushes and trees, and you had to kind of like bend down and kind of creep into it. It was like this little sacred grove. And on a little shrine beside where the spring came up, there was this kind of crudely formed figure of the earth goddess made from clay. And other groups, apart from Buddhafield, used these fields. And people were always making little offerings to the earth goddess. So there was all kinds of things in there. There's like crystals and feathers and bones and shells, you know. And for me and many others, there was a sense of completeness in having a shrine to the old gods and goddesses in this place where we were practicing the Dharma. It felt like there was a place in the spiritual life for seeing ourselves as part of nature, for the earth as well as the celestial light. And it felt like the sort of stuff of so-called ordinary life wasn't being kept separate from the Dharma. And the interconnectedness that we talk so much about was extended to seeing ourselves as really part of the web of life. So I often wonder what our culture in the UK would be like if we were still venerating the old gods and goddesses, you know, if we still saw images of the green man and the goddess everywhere, or if in America the great spirits were still present. I don't believe that we'd be in this kind of climate crisis that we're in now. If we still lived in a world where there were spirits of trees and rocks. In short, what would life be like for us if the world was still alive? And what have we lost as Buddhists through not having the Dharma rooted in our ethnic religion? I find it interesting just how little response we as a spiritual community have had to climate change. You know, we want to save all beings from suffering and we want to live in accord with the truth of interconnectedness. Yet somehow we often fail to see the consequences of some of our actions and some of our inactions. So there's simple realities such as half the Earth's oxygen is made by plankton, and that's interconnectedness. It took literally years to get the Sustainable Buddha Center scheme off the ground. It was so much effort, you know, it just kind of doesn't really add up somehow. And sometimes I wonder if aspects of Buddhism itself can kind of lead us to taking a bit of an eternalistic viewpoint. You know, we talk about world systems coming and going, these sort of huge cosmological perspectives of aeons coming and going. And I've actually heard it used as an argument that because everything's impermanent, we shouldn't be overly focused on trying to save life on this planet now. So, I mean, it's true that the Earth has always seen mass extinctions, but the difference here, the ethical difference here, is that this time it's being caused by human activity. Anyway, rather than focusing too much on like how much more we could be doing, and sort of, because there's always more we could be doing, you know, or sort of feeling bad that we haven't done enough, in recent years I've been thinking that maybe the focus needs to be on reconnection with our pagan roots, to reconnect with our sense of the world as being alive, and ourselves as being part of nature, no better and no worse than any other living things. In the West, at least, it's so easy to feel separate from nature. We have no idea how dependent we are on the interconnected web of life. And we have no idea how much effect on that web that we are having. So I'm sure you all know the story of Indra's net. So it's from Indian mythology. It's said that the god Indra possessed a wonderful net made entirely of jewels, and every jewel in the net reflected every other jewel in the net, and their reflections, and the reflections of the reflections. So it's very important we don't get into blaming ourselves for not doing enough. I believe the most important thing that we can do is to just try to reconnect with the natural world, because it's the loss of that connection which is at the root of our current situation. And we need connection before love can really flow, and our actions need to come from love and connectedness, not some sort of contracted sense of guilt. So I'd like to take you on a little journey now, back to the birth of our universe. So I'd like to just have a little look at the interconnected processes that brought life into being on this planet. Okay, so 13 billion years ago, so far as we know, there was a Big Bang, which is kind of an understatement. And matter, Where that came from, I don't think anyone knows, but matter was flung out across the universe, and over billions of years, dust came together to form rocks, and rocks came together to form the earth. So the heavier metals mostly sank to the core, becoming a factor in the earth having a magnetic field. And 4 billion years ago, our planet was basically a lava ball. At some point, the Earth was hit by another body, a sort of Mars-sized body known as Theia, which greatly increased the speed of the Earth's rotation. And the matter flung out from that collision eventually coalesced to form our moon. So the Earth slowly cooled and the surface formed a crust. And then 3.9 billion years ago, the Earth was bombarded by meteors. And I love this bit. This meteor bombardment lasted for 20 million years. So that's a lot of meteors. And these meteors contained tiny crystals, which contained minute drops of water. And this is how the sea was formed. So volcanoes began to rise up out of this ocean, and the cooling lava formed islands. The atmosphere was still toxic and the temperature was scorching. And then 3.8 billion years ago, there came Meteor Attack Part 2. But this time there was already water for the meteors to fall into, and so they dissolved, releasing carbon and amino acids, the building blocks of life. So what we call bacteria formed from these building blocks. And this cyanobacteria turns sunlight into food, transforming carbon dioxide and water into a kind of glucose. And the byproduct of all of this was oxygen. So as far as we know, that is how life began on our planet. And so far, we haven't found life anywhere else. Life, it would seem, is incredibly rare. So we're not separate from nature. But nature is not a refuge. The Earth Goddess is not a refuge. So I don't know how many of you watched David Attenborough's last series, Planet Earth 2. Yeah? I knew that I'd definitely hit middle age when I realised that I'd actually started to fancy David Attenborough. So I've watched every programme that David Attenborough has done. But the longer I've practiced the Dharma, the more sensitive I've become. And I literally sobbed the whole way through Planet Earth 2. Such sufferings, such hardships that living beings endure. So nature is not a refuge. But nonetheless, life itself is a kind of magic. And life is a thing of beauty. So there's some interesting references to the Earth Goddess in Buddhism. In the Sutra of Golden Light, the Earth Goddess promises to appear whenever the Sutra is preached and protect those who preach the Sutra. And very famously, the Earth Goddess appears at the time of the Buddha's enlightenment. So Mara, the Lord of Limitation, rises up and asks the Buddha what right he has to sit on the Vajrasana, the seat of enlightenment. Who has witnessed the Buddha's practice? And so the Buddha makes the earth-touching gesture. He touches the earth with his fingertips, and the Earth Goddess appears, and she testifies that she has borne witness to the Buddha's practice over countless lifetimes. So I can really recommend, by the way, using this earth-touching mudra. If you ever need confidence, I can remember using it in my private ordination, actually. There's this bit where you get asked something like, you know, and are you effectively going for refuge? And Mara just kicked in really strongly for me at that point, and I just sort of thought, God, am I? You know, what if I'm not? You know, so, but I just made the earth-touching mudra, and it really was like the Earth Goddess kind of came to my rescue, and my faith in my practice returned. So when I was ordained, I took up the Green Tara visualization practice. And Green Tara is an archetypal bodhisattva. So there's so many different Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and they all represent different aspects of the enlightened mind. And Tara, or green Tara, the form that I visualise, represents active compassion. So we've got a lovely standing Tara here, but the green Tara that I visualise is seated, and most sort of peaceful Buddha figures are pictured in full meditation pose. But green Tara has her left leg in meditation posture, but with her right leg, she's stepping down into the world to go to the aid of living beings. And with her right hand, she makes a gesture of infinite giving. So Tara is a bodhisattva, and the bodhisattva makes a vow to save all beings from suffering, though he or she knows that in reality there are no beings to save. Wisdom sees that there are no separate selves, there's only interconnectedness. Compassion vows to save these beings from suffering. And we talk a lot in Buddhism about emptiness and no self, and I like to always use the example of a rainbow to illustrate this. So emptiness. So if you have sun and you have rain and a rainbow arises. So if one of those conditions changes, so say the sun goes behind a cloud, then the rainbow ceases to be. So it's not that the rainbow was never real, just that it only arose in dependence on conditions. And everything has this same nature. In the Heart Sutra, Avalokiteshvara looks down into the five skandhas and he sees they are all empty. Form is no other than emptiness. Emptiness no other than form. Form is only emptiness. Emptiness only form. Feeling, thought and choice, consciousness itself, are the same as this. So what are these things empty of? They're empty of a self. And yet Tara steps down into the world to go to the aid of living beings. Not long after I was ordained, I went to visit Bante and I asked him about his experience of doing the Green Tara practice. I actually asked him if he had any tips, which I can't believe I said. But his answer was very interesting. He said, well, you could think of nature. Nature is green. And it reminded me of a good friend who's dead now. He was a heroin addict. And he was telling me once about this acid trip he'd done, where he'd seen nature kind of endlessly unfolding before him, saying, there you are, and kind of endless giving. So given the need for action in the suffering world, and given the enormity of the task of transforming ourselves, what value is there on reflecting on Buddhas and Bodhisattvas? So why meditate on Tara? Well, there's this thing called the Four Factors of Enlightenment, Vasubandhu's Four Factors of Enlightenment. I was writing this on solitary and didn't have anything to Google, so I might have the second and third the wrong way around, but it still plays out the same. So Vasubandhu's four factors are recollection of the Buddhas, seeing the faults of conditioned existence, observing the suffering of sentient beings, and contemplation of the virtues of the enlightened ones. So recollection of the Buddhas, well, for me that's often just sort of remembering that there is a path to enlightenment at all, and I'm supposed to be on it, you know. But more traditionally, it's bearing in mind that the historical Buddha, bearing in mind that he was human like ourselves, and that there's a path that we can follow. Seeing the faults of conditioned existence, well, you know, seeing that everything's impermanent, seeing dukkha, and observing the suffering of sentient beings, well, we don't have to look very far to see suffering. So that brings us to contemplation of the virtues of the enlightened ones. So when we reflect on Tara or other figures, it brings us into contact with their qualities, and that has a refining influence on our minds and our hearts. So for instance, if we look at Tara's outstretched hand, that has an effect. We need to bear in mind what we're moving towards as well as what we're trying to move away from. Also, the rational mind is only a small part of our beings. Most of us is the unconscious, and the unconscious responds to myth and symbol and poetry. So sometimes I can sort of say, with open-handed generosity, I purify my body, and it just doesn't really move me at all. But if I look at Tara's outstretched hand, kind of going, there you are, that never fails to move me. So anyway, the four factors are balanced. If we only look at the suffering of sentient beings, then it's really unlikely that we will become kinder and more capable. It's much more likely that we'll become depressed. And I'm speaking from personal experience. You know, if you're just sort of in the activist world and you're just kind of attending to suffering, and, you know, it really brings you down, you know. We have to bear in mind what it is we're moving towards. And so we contemplate the virtues of the enlightened ones. So after the tea break, we're going to do a sevenfold puja to Green Tara in this spirit. So Green Tara has a counterpart. She has a consort. And her consort is Amoghasiddhi, the Green Buddha. And Amoghasiddhi doesn't appear in the blue sky like the other Buddhas. Amoghasiddhi appears in the midnight sky when everything is dark. And he's very much associated with fearlessness. And with his right hands, he makes a mudra of fearlessness, fear not. And his wisdom is the all-accomplishing wisdom. And I often think that if there was a Buddha that we needed right now for the sort of dark times that lie ahead, where nature hangs in the balance, it's Amoghasiddhi. I mentioned earlier that little field where we used to hold the first Buddha field retreats. I went back there when my daughter was really small because I wanted to show her the goddess shrine, and the whole thing had gone. After the owner had died, it had just been turned over to a cattle field. So every single little tree, every single bush, and all the wildflowers had gone. And of course, the goddess shrine was no more. Things are so precious and so fragile, and we are in danger of losing it completely. It was in that field that I first heard a talk on Tara. It was on the first Buddha Field Women's Retreat. And Vidya Shree gave this really beautiful talk about Tara. And at one point she mentioned this Tara form called Kadiravani Tara, Tara of the Acacia Forest. And as soon as she said Tara of the Acacia Forest, I spontaneously burst into uncontrollable sobbing. And I was quite new at the time, and I was really embarrassed. And the sort of shrine bender was quite crowded, and there wasn't really an obvious way out. So I put a blanket over my head. And later that day, I asked for ordination. So Tara's always had a very strong impact on me, you know. And I had a realisation about my childhood experiences a few years ago. It was a very hot day, and I was in my garden, and I found two baby birds in the grass, and one of them was already dead, and the other one was still just about breathing. And I could see like blood flowing from broken blood vessels sort of beneath its skin, which was transparent, and it had these huge eyes that were still sealed shut and would never open. And it was this tiny living thing in such desperation and beyond saving, and it was lying alone in the grass with this really hot sun beating down on it, completely alone, and just this sort of fragile nakedness. And suddenly in that moment, the world was completely transformed, and there wasn't a bird and a me and a garden. There was only love. So in the days that followed, I reflected on this and on the mysteriousness of this thing that's love, that seems to be in everything. And I had this realization about my childhood experiences at sunset. In the Green Tara visualization, Tara has Amitabha, the Red Buddha, associated with sunset, up in her hair knot. And my favourite part of the practice is seeing Amitabha in Tara's hair knot, sort of like the setting sun, going down into the spreading dark of her hair, and her body kind of deep green beneath, like the earth breathing at twilight. And what I realised was, that's what that childhood experience was always about. Somehow it was always Tara. Time isn't always this linear thing that we think it is. Magic is real and it happens. So it is Buddhist Action Month, and of course I'd like to encourage us all to take some kind of action. But most of all, I'd encourage us all to just try to reconnect, to remember that we are part of nature. So I'd like to end with a quote from Rilke. Once for each thing, just once, no more. And we too, just once, and never again. But to have been this once, completely, even if only once, to have been at one with the earth seems beyond undoing. Thank you.